Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to the New Books in Hindu Studies podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. More importantly, I have the pleasure today of speaking with Dr. Stuart Ray Sarbacher, who's associate professor at the School of History, Philosophy, and Religion at Oregon State University. Hello, Stuart, and welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Raj.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. We had the good fortune of interacting not so long ago. You gave a talk at the OCHS Online Weekend School on yoga. Yes?
That's right. Yeah, the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies. Yeah, and it was quite a treat actually to be part of that program, which I thought was quite edifying. I've been working my way through the recordings of the other speakers over the past couple of weeks. It was a really great program.
I will put a link to your talk in the program in the description. In the notes for this podcast, but it was so interesting. This podcast is so related to that online weekend school. I was asked, you know, a little bit last minute if I would put one together for December. This was maybe with 3 weeks notice type thing, 3-4 weeks. There was just a bit of reshuffling and they asked if I would be able to do it. And I said, sure. And then I thought, you know, let me network through the podcast. And I realized that they've just been, I knew I wanted to do it on yoga. That I just kind of knew. And I didn't occur to me that there were like 10 brand new yoga books in the last year just on this podcast. I thought, wow, what a burgeoning field of study, right? Speaking of, we should get to the topic of this podcast, which is your fascinating, fantastic new book, Tracing the Path of Yoga, the History and Philosophy of Indian Mind-Body Discipline, brand spanking new, officially to be out tomorrow. Now, in the timeless time of podcast worlds, this may have a little bearing, but we are currently, as I speak, in the Eastern time zone at least, we are on the 31st of December, the last day of 2020, the eve of a new world, a new year, but also January 1st happens to be the publication date officially for your book. So very timely.
Yeah, thank you.
So tell us, how did you get down the path of writing this book? What's the genesis of this project?
Yeah, thanks, Raj. You know, I think there were a number of factors involved. One was a long-standing abiding interest that I had personally in the history and philosophy of yoga, and especially as a scholar of yoga studies, getting the big picture, so to speak. And I was inspired in my own graduate research by the classic work by Mircea Eliade, Yoga, Immortality, and Freedom, as well as works by David Gordon White, and perhaps more recently, Jeffrey Samuel. And I've always had an affinity for these kind of bigger picture presentations of the history and philosophy of yoga. One part of that inspiration then is a kind of personal academic kind of interest in the topic. Another part of it, though, has been teaching the subject to students and often struggling to kind of cobble together a variety of sources to really cover the narrative arc of the history of yoga and to some extent Tantra in a kind of cohesive way. And as you're well aware, Eliade's book is really, you know, dated in many respects. it also doesn't really even address the whole issue of modern yoga. It sort of stops at the pre-modern era as if the complete story has been told. And really, there's been a whole generation of scholarship that's opened the door to a lot of different other very important facets of both, you know, pre-modern and modern yoga. And so, you know, part of it came out of my desire to really master this field of or topic, but part of it also came out of a kind of pedagogical need to have a kind of cohesive narrative to offer to students that would introduce them to the history and philosophy, and along the way, bring them into some of the theoretical conversations within Hindu studies and religious studies more broadly.
It's fascinating. This obviously is a topic that's of personal interest to you. If you don't mind me asking, do you also practice? Is it part of your personal life in some way?
Yeah, I do. And, you know, I consider myself a scholar practitioner of yoga. I'm a registered yoga teacher with the Yoga Alliance. And I actually teach a course at Oregon State University called Theory and Practice of Modern Yoga, which looks at the history of modern yoga, really late 19th century forward, through both, you know, historical and anthropological sources, as well as through the lens of different practitioner representations of yoga. And in the class, we spend half of the time in the traditional classroom and half of the time in a yoga studio experimenting with the practices of yoga. So for example, we have one session which is dedicated to the sun salutation or Surya Namaskar. And we look at the modern history of the Surya Namaskar as a component of yoga. And then we go next door into the yoga studio and we practice the sun salutation and reflect on the relationship between the historical sources, the practitioner representations, and what it feels like to practice that in an embodied way. So it's both a part of my own life in terms of my own practice of yoga and meditation, but also it's something I actively teach as well.
My most favorite analogy for straddling those two intimately related worlds of practice and theory is sort of looking at music theory or music history in one room and then, you know, jamming in the next room if one if one is not tone deaf.
That's a great analogy, I think. And I will say this, that my experience out with practitioners in communities out in the world has impacted in very profound ways the way that I think about yoga as a scholar. Among other things, it's given me much deeper insights in some respects into the kind of social and cultural aspect of yoga, you know, yoga as being something that's transmitted through living communities. And likewise, as a practitioner, my scholarly work has definitely informed the way that I go about my own practice, how I understand and interpret what I see out in the world. And I should say, with this particular book, you know, I'm really trying to cast a bit of a wide net here, both, you know, as a resource for scholars who want to kind of go deeper into the literature and history of yoga, but also for practitioners, because I think if, you know, a good read through this book, I think would open a person's eyes to a variety of elements of yoga that might not be apparent immediately, that might attune people in ways to their own practice and also the communities in which those practices are situated. So I hope that it will be something appealing to readers across that spectrum.
Tell us about the structure of the book in terms of the chapters and the sort of chronological layers of the discussion.
The book itself is really structured to create a kind of historical arc. But that being said, you know, I really tried to set the stage early on by introducing a number of the kind of key concepts that emerge within the context of the larger arc of yoga practice. In fact, you know, one of the things I say early on is, you know, if a person's really looking primarily to understand modern yoga, maybe read that first chapter, which is all about defining yoga, and then read the last chapter, which is about modern and contemporary practices of yoga. Those two together, I think, would give a basic literacy as to the story of modern yoga traditions within a larger kind of historical context. But really, the kind of core of the book is going from the earliest sort of stages of yoga's development, what I refer to as proto-yoga, and theories about where the building blocks of yoga emerge in Indian history, particularly in the Indus civilization and in the Vedic traditions, and then really follows an arc that extends through primarily Hinduism, Buddhism, and Jainism over the course of the early centuries BCE through the classical, medieval, and then modern eras. So, you know, it really is a kind of a big picture take. And along the way, I try to kind of provide a kind of historical, cultural, political, and even economic snapshot of what's happening at each of these different phases of yoga's history, so that it isn't just sort of the practices out there without any sort of context, but you understand that they're part of a kind of transforming Indic society.
In terms of chapter two, the building blocks, as it were, in terms of Indus Valley civilization elements and the Vedic tradition, why don't you share some of those building blocks with us? What are you looking at there?
Well, primarily in referring to what I call proto-yoga, in part because, you know, the explicit references to yoga, especially as a discipline, and that's really what I'm looking at yoga primarily through the rubric of a kind of mind-body discipline, you know, appears probably not until the 5th or 6th century BCE. But a lot has happened before that in terms of, you know, the Vedic tradition and the Indus civilization. And one of the things I get into is how, you know, if we look at the Indus civilization, you know, roughly 2500 BCE, as the kind of foundational strata of Indian civilization, there's quite a few theories about some of the archaeological evidence there, in particular, a steatite or soapstone seal that bears an image that kind of looks like someone seated in a meditative position. That's been often claimed as a yogi, or either a proto-yogi or even a proto-Shiva. And, you know, my argument in the text is it's intriguing, but we have no literary evidence to back that up. We have no other sort of data to support that theory, and that we're probably better off looking primarily to the Vedic materials for, you know, more substantive, conclusive ideas about the history of yoga. And I will say this, one of the things that came out of doing this research for me personally was a much more profound sense of how many of the building blocks of yoga are already present within the Vedic tradition and Vedic civilization. You know, and one example of that is I really came to the conclusion over the course of writing the book that mantra in particular has been a thread that has been extremely important throughout the history of yoga, whether in the Hindu, Buddhist, or Jain tradition. In some cases, it's perhaps not as apparent as other contexts, but nonetheless, it's a thread that really runs through the history of yoga. Other disciplines like breath control or pranayama, you know, are an important part of the Vedic corpus, as well as various forms of tapas or ascetic practice. So, you know, many of the building blocks are clearly there, and we don't really have to speculate as much as we can just sort of see them transparently there. Another really important thing that, you know, I've really sort of drawn from this research is that though some scholars will argue that yoga officially appears much later in this sort of post-Vedic period, in part because they point to the Buddhist and Jain emphasis on cyclic existence, on liberating insight and that type of thing. But in my opinion, that's just one part of a bigger puzzle. And one of the key pieces is what I call the numinous dimension of yoga, yoga as self-disciplining that leads to extraordinary capacities. which is to some extent really clearly evident in some of the Vedic passages, as well as the Vedic commentarial literature. So you can really look to that pre-Buddhist and Jain, and even to some extent Upanishadic period, to see many of the building blocks of the sorts of visionary experiences that come to characterize yoga in the early period and in the classical era. So there's a lot going on there. And I would say doing this work has really convinced me much more than I was before that we really need to look at the Vedic tradition if we want to get at the roots of the phenomenon we come to understand as yoga.
So give us an example of the passage or passage that you look at as evidence for this numinous experience you refer to.
Yeah, so one of the, in the Vedic context, one of the classic examples is, Rigveda 10:136, the so-called Keshin hymn, which, provides images of this long-haired muni or ascetic who drinks some sort of agent or visha, flies amongst the gods, and there's hints of other powers such as mind reading, in many respects, giving us a kind of snapshot image of a transformed ascetic practitioner who's achieving divine powers. And by numinous, in part, I'm referring to the idea of becoming a numen, becoming like a spirit. The boundary between the human and the divine becoming fluid, and humans taking on the attributes that are typically associated with gods and goddesses. And this is just a really critical part of the practice of yoga throughout its history. When we start to see the formal yoga systems, one of the things we see is this idea that when you discipline your mind and body, you become very powerful. You become like the beings who exist in these higher cosmological realms. Likewise, there's a passage in the Atharva Veda about the Brahmacharan, the person who practices kind of the idealized self-restraint of Vedic disciplehood and become charged with this sort of extraordinary power. And you could say, well, in either case, maybe there's some degree of hyperbole going on as a sort of, way of accentuating perhaps the nobility and virtues of those stations. At the same time, the literature of yoga is throughout its history filled with examples of these sorts of extraordinary capacities that come out of ascetic and yogic discipline.
Would you say that yoga ultimately hails from Indian asceticism?
Well, I think they're intimately tied together. And one way of thinking about it, or one way I've found useful to think about it, is in some contexts, yoga and tapas are virtually identical. So in some of the different literary contexts, and I think in the contemporary context as well, yoga and tapas become kind of interchangeable terms for self-discipline. And in principle, the idea that when you discipline your mind and your body, you become very powerful, but that power is sort of ambiguous. And of course, we have famous Hindu narratives, such as Ravana, the villain of the Ramayana, who obtains extraordinary power and vulnerability through his own efforts of tapas. And it sort of gets at the moral ambivalence of tapas. And there are other examples of that, of individuals who, for not so savory reasons, discipline their minds and bodies and become very powerful, almost overwhelmingly powerful. And in that sense, yoga as just a simple disciplining of the self that yields these powers or capacities, I think is a kind of baseline common kind of way of thinking about it. But once we hit the kind of early to full-on classical era, we see tapas, asceticism, being kind of subsumed within the rubric of yoga as one element among many others. So famously in the Patanjali yoga system, in the Ashtanga yoga, tapas is one of the factors of niyama. So it's one of the observances that the yoga practitioner performs. And there it's associated with, among other things, forms of self-discipline, like fasting in particular. So I think there are two ways, at least, to look at this. One is to sort of look at tapas and yoga as both terms that relate to self-discipline, but then as the more systemic traditions of yoga develop, tapas is sort of subsumed within yoga, in yoga's more systematic formulation.
What would you say is the relationship? Complex question, more generative than conclusive in terms of a response. But the relationship between yoga and tantra, particularly with respect to your observation of the prevalence of mantric recitation throughout the history of yoga, how would you describe the relationship?
Yeah, I think they're intimately connected in a number of ways. And one of the most prominent sort of connections that I make early on in the book, that I think is something I return to on numerous occasions, is if, you know, we look at yoga first as a kind of disciplining of the mind and the body, you know, that arises out of this Indic religious context and in particular out of the Hindu, Buddhist, and Jain context, that then becomes both synonymous with a goal of practice as well as different methods of practice that lead to either these extraordinary accomplishments, you know, mastery over one's embodiment or worldly experience, as well as mastery over the process of birth and rebirth, what I call these numinous and cessative goals, either obtaining power in the world or kind of freedom or liberation from attachment and aversion and other forces that bind us to the world. Tantra is a way of accelerating the process of spiritual development through extraordinary means. And so Tantra both in many cases embraces yogic practices. You know, for example, yogic disciplines of the subtle body, of mantra practice, of utilizing pranayama and other techniques to manage one sort of energetic inner life in order to accelerate the process of spiritual development. I think they're sort of intimately connected together. And much like yoga, Tantra has a kind of ambivalence within it in terms of the power that one obtains through the practice of Tantra might either mean transfiguration or transformation into a kind of deity-like being, or it can lend towards this idea of liberation. And I think in the Tantra context, often the two are wedded together, and you have these ideas of jivan mukti, of liberation in life, where you both possess these sorts of extraordinary powers and you're free from bondage to the process of birth and rebirth. One of the theories I sort of press a bit in the text, which is, you know, perhaps a bit speculative, but I find quite intriguing, is the idea that Tantra may have emerged out of a kind of interface between the kind of yogic and tantric practices that you see develop in particularly the Hindu tradition and female possession ritualist traditions, where women were possessed by goddesses, and that there's a kind of interface between those two things. And what you find, I think, over time is both yogic methods being integrated within tantric paradigms, but also certain tantric methods being integrated into yogic paradigms as well. So there's a kind of fluidity between the boundaries of yoga and tantra, I think, especially as you get to the medieval era, where in many cases that boundary is very thin, if it exists at all.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and
and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
The interplay of which you speak really reinforces to my mind one of my two favorite metaphors for what we call Hinduism. The first is a jungle, which we need not get into now, but the second is a tapestry. And I think of it as having these five key strands or patterns. And one of those patterns is tantric, one is Vedic, et cetera, et cetera. And really it's like any beautiful piece of art, you may be able to discern the elements, but the interplay is, it's more than the sum of its parts. And it really becomes difficult to separate out what's Vedic, what's tantric, what's yogic, what's Puranic, et cetera, et cetera. And also, when you talk about in your book, the bifurcation between, how do you phrase it? Cessation and numinosity, correct?
Yeah.
I can't help but think of the Devi Mahatmya cultivating. My brain is not working today. I need more sleep. Culminating, or more coffee. The Devi Mahatmya culminates in this dual boon. The Devi speaks out of both sides of her mouth, as it were, to give moksha, liberation, cessation, in your language, to the merchant, and kingship, sovereignty, power over the world to the king, and this ambivalence, it's profound, and it's intriguing. You see this at every turn in Hindudom, and certainly in the discourse of yoga. Speaking of narratives of the goddess and such, what do you find in terms of yoga in the epics and Puranas?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I was going to be talking to you, Raj. I made sure I, thought through this a bit, knowing about your sort of deep work on the Puranas, and I perhaps should tread a bit carefully. But
for the record, I turn off the specialist brain when I do these interviews, for the most part. Please proceed, assured that you'll be fine.
So there are a couple of things, that really stand out to me about the Puranas and with respect to yoga. And one of them is just simply that for all of the academic and popular interest in yoga, very little attention has in fact been paid to the Puranas, despite, as I think you'll agree with me, it being one of the most important bodies of narrative and didactic literature in the Hindu tradition, or in other words, telling stories and teaching people how to practice Hinduism. Would you agree with
without
that?
I would say, in my personal view, without question.
Well, I'm glad.
Emphatically so.
Agree on that. So there are really two key points that I'm at least implicitly making about the Puranic narratives of yoga and Puranic teachings about yoga in the book here. And one of them is that in this extremely important body of Hindu literature, which is, what I think one should go to really get a sense of, the kind of core of Hindu narrative practice, theology, and so forth. One of the things you see is that the gods themselves are portrayed in many cases as practitioners of yoga, as embodiments of yoga, and is wielding the power or yoga bala of yoga. And I think it points to the ways in which yoga has been very much a critical component of the mainstream of Hindu narrative and practice. Shiva, for example, is referred to as Yogeshvara, And likewise, in the epics, you see Vishnu referred to in that language as well, as masters or lords of yoga. In the Shiva Purana, Devi is referred to as a kind of patron of yoga practitioners. And in some cases, Shiva, for example, is portrayed in the kind of iconography of a yogin or ascetic. In the Shiva Purana, there's profoundly effusive language about the nature of Shiva as a yogin, as a practitioner of yoga, as a master of yoga, with innumerable epithets or special names given to Shiva that reflect his mastery of yogic practices. And so if one is sort of wondering, well, you know, how important is yoga in the context of, you know, Hindu narrative literature and the representations of Hindu gods and goddesses, in the Puranas, one of the things you see is it's critical. It becomes woven into the very fabric of how God or the goddess is to be understood. The second point that I'm, again, you know, at least implicitly, if not explicitly, making is that the didactic sections of the Puranas on yoga, which feature a range of different methods of yoga, including the sort of split between karma, bhakti, and raja yoga, for example. There are sections that talk specifically about Shiva yoga, the yoga of Shiva. But in many, if not most, of the major Puranas, including the Vishnu Purana, the Agni Purana, the Vayu Purana, the Kurma Purana, the Linga Purana, and Bhagavata Purana, you see yoga integrated into the Ashtanga yoga or eight-limbed framework, which is most often associated with Patanjali, but there's no mention of Patanjali explicitly within these passages. But nonetheless, a kind of integration of yoga into an eight-limbed paradigm that draws together not only a kind of classical framework of yoga, but integrates different sectarian orientations. So a Vaishnava might, you know, practice dhyana or meditation on Vishnu or Shaiva on Shiva, as well as integrating what were probably emergent variations on asana and pranayama practice. And then I think very importantly, integrating together a kind of sectarian devotion. You know, someone who's reading the Shiva or Linga Purana is typically going to be a Shaiva devotee, but they're also going to learn the Sankhya system of yoga philosophy. But ultimately, it's all subsumed in many cases under a larger Vedantic banner. So we see a willingness to kind of see sectarian identity as well as these different philosophical systems as all able to be reconciled into one larger yogic frame. And I think in many respects, that is a foundation upon which many of the modern representations of yoga are built. So for example, when I look at BKS Iyengar's Light on Yoga and the way that he uses the Ashtanga yoga paradigm or eight-limb paradigm in Light on Yoga to frame the history and philosophy of yoga, I don't think that's a novel approach. In fact, I think you see that quite evident within the Puranic literature. So he's not innovating as much as he's representing a kind of traditional way of thinking about and framing yoga. So there's a lot to be said, I think, about the Puranic materials. And I hope, you know, one hope I would have is that this might spark others' interests in looking more deeply at that issue.
It was a fascinating chapter. Maybe to my surprise, it was chapter five of Stewart's book is Hindu epic, Puranic and scholastic representations of yoga. I believe in your talk at the OCHS, you were talking about elements of the Shiva Purana, if I'm not mistaken.
Go ahead.
No, the Puranas, I mean, there's so much there yet to be mined. And we're I think, just now getting over the hangover of the slicing and dicing and historicism and the sort of dismissing of them as sort of haphazard or patchwork or Brahmanical conceits. We're finally over that hangover. And now we can, part of the work that I do is to develop sort of strategies for how to deal with texts like the Puranas that are understandably unwieldy for scholarship because they're such patchwork quilts Yeah.
Yes. I couldn't agree more. And the Shiva Purana, which I had a project on recently and presented at the World Sanskrit Conference about, you know, some people argue that these Shiva Purana in its sort of modern recension is a kind of hybridized text and, you know, should be thought of as a relatively sort of recent patchwork invention, though parts of it may go back, you know, to a considerably early date. But you know, reading through it, one sees that there are different strata of texts being represented there, but they each part has, you know, gives you a lens into a particular, often sectarian world or particular philosophical view. And one of the things I love about the way in which the Puranas deal with the Ashtanga Yoga is, unlike the more sort of, let's say, elite commentarial literature, the Puranas have more of an eye to the kind of practicalities of life and how Ashtanga Yoga is to be instantiated within a kind of living tradition. So it's not this sort of abstract entity out there as much as it is a more kind of discussion and description of how yoga is to be practiced by people in whatever situation they find themselves in the world. So it's a little bit more attuned to a kind of social and cultural context, I think, than you see within the elite literature.
I think that is core to the function and the usage of the Puranas. To my mind, the various layers, when you're looking at a Purana, this is Hinduism, right? So the cultural software of Hinduism, the Puranas in many ways are the most up-to-date version of that software, where elements of the software may be ancient. Mm-hmm. Yes, of course, and foundational. But culture, it's dynamic. The Puranas, they celebrate dynamism. The polyphony of the Puranas is the polyphony of Hinduism. That's why it's this made up word of everything else that we call Hinduism, because it is everything else. And there is no elegant way. If you squint the right way and the sun's shining, you may see the tapestry one moment and then see the jungle the next moment. But nevertheless, for the very same reasons that the Puranas are unwieldy as objects of Western scholarship are the very same reasons that make them emblematic of what we call Hinduism, equally unwieldy to Western scholarship.
Thank you. I appreciate that very much. And I think there's a lot more to be learned on the topic of yoga within the context of the Puranas. I think you'd mentioned earlier the epics, and you know, one of the things I was really trying to do in the kind of, you know, limited amount of space I have within this text to talk about the epics is to, you know, to some extent, you know, bring such a wealth of data into a kind of snapshot focus, which is tricky because you lose many of these, you know, complicating details in that process. So, you know, balancing, you know, providing a kind of coherent snapshot that's going to be useful for a reader, especially one who wants to kind of go deeper into this, and not sort of, you know, overly sanitizing it or, you know, overly reifying one particular reading or interpretation of those texts was very important. I've always found that or let me put it this way, when in the context of the classroom, we're talking about the role of yoga in the epics and Puranas, I've always wanted to have at least a kind of capsule summary for the students to work through so that in a relatively short period of time, they'd at least get the essentials of these stories in order to have a kind of foundation for understanding, you know, why yoga is expressed in the way it is in the Gita, for example. But the challenge then is to provide that kind of capsule narrative without closing off a lot of the other important elements of the story. And so with respect to the epics, I've tried to provide these kind of core narratives, linking them to the kind of important discourses about yoga within those texts, and then, you know, amply footnoting it. So if people want to go deeper on any element or aspect of this, they'll have the opportunity to do so. And I think similarly with the pranic materials, I mean, it's such a vast, vast amount of material that there is a danger that, you know, presenting five pages about it is going to give the reader the impression that it's considerably more homogeneous than it actually is. And so as with much of the book, I'm amply noting different sources to refer to in order for the reader to go deeper and see more of that complexity if they want to. Oh, so you know, it's a balancing act.
Yes, and good books are beginnings, yeah, more than endings. And with the Puranas, I mean, I find myself teaching on the Puranas all the time and presenting interpretations of them. And I think at the outset, it is to be known or to be declared, to be clarified that these are textured texts that have served various functions over centuries, if not millennia. And so we are using them for a purpose in this time. We can glean a little bit about the world behind the text, a little bit, next to nothing. And here's the world within the text and how to make sense of that. And here's one way to make sense of that. Or, you know, this is, I think the guiding principle is that there is no one way to interpret a rich narrative because it's doing so many things and it'll continue doing stuff for subsequent ages based on how it hits future readers. There's this, I was teaching this course, what was it? My goodness, my brain today. Yoga and Hindu Mythology. It was at Yogi Studies, Seth Powell's platform. Fantastic platform. Had a fantastic experience. Great students. Couldn't believe so many people were interested in learning about Hindu mythology. Nevertheless, I decided to bring up a story that came to mind that I wanted to fold into to the text to teach something about yoga. And I knew when I was designing the course, and I really want to talk about this ancient rivalry between Vasishta and Vishvamitra. Between these two sages, and to me, one is sort of Brahmanical inner spiritual power, and the other is, you know, royal kingly outer Kshatriya power. Because, you know, Vishvamitra is the only Kshatriya who ever actually becomes a Brahmin through extraordinary effort. I just remember when I was looking at the Valmiki Ramayana for my master's research, this must have been 2008-ish. The story stayed with me. I couldn't remember the details, but I have to go back to the story because there's so much juice there. I look into the text and basically Vishwamitra steals Vasishtha's cow. Right, this Brahmanical image of, you know, the butter, the ghee, you know, the passive ahimsa, this visage of Brahmanical power, and and the cow runs back to Vasishtha and says, "Well, have I wronged you in some way? I'm so sad. Why are you getting rid of me? I thought I was good." Vasishtha says, no, lovely cow. I think in this iteration, it's Shabala. Lovely Shabala, you're being taken from me. This Kshatriya, he's a king. He's taking you from me. I'm powerless. What can I do? And she said, you know, the power of a Kshatriya is no power at all. It's the Brahmana who has true power. And I thought I was going to argue that they were talking about yogic power. And I thought, you know, this may be a stretch. But then a few passages later, Vishwamitra comes back with an army and conquers Vasishtha's forces. And Vasishtha then says to the cow, produce more forces through your yogic power. And literally uses the word yogic. Huh. I thought, this is so good. Right, and it's there. There's so much there. It's not in sutra form. But this is why these narratives are the tissues of Hindu culture. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I love that story for a number of reasons. One of them being that as I went through the material for the book, one of the things I tried to be as conscientious about as possible was getting to primary sources when, say, I read a secondary author who said that such and such passage talks about the practice of yoga. Actually, go to that passage and take a look at it myself. And it's interesting how many cases people talk about a particular passage being about yoga. But if you actually go and read the passage itself, there's no mention of yoga. The term yoga doesn't appear, or the term yogi or yogin doesn't appear. But then there are other contexts where perhaps you don't expect it to even appear, and there it is. One example of that, you know, I found was the pervasive use of the term yogi or yogin within Buddhist literature, especially in the classical era. And again, you know, there's quite a bit of debate over sort of who's using this term first. And there are certain arguments, for example, to say Patanjali was borrowing heavily from Buddhist and potentially also Jain thinking when he's put together the Yoga Sutra. Nonetheless, I think there was perhaps some response going on in the Buddhist and Jain side to really adopting rubric that was developing within the Hindu tradition as well. But my larger point being, to get back to the larger point, that it's interesting how in some cases, you know, passages are referred to as yoga because they have elements which relate to the theory and practice of yoga, and others where yoga is just clearly the rubric and language that's being used. And again, I think if I could rewrite that chapter on the yoga in the Hindu epic and Puranic context, I would probably spend a bit more time talking about the concept of yoga bala, this idea that there's certain powers of yoga, or there's a power of yoga that sages and gods possess.
That's all right. I'm glad you saved something for our co-authored article.
Perhaps.
You never know, stranger things have happened. What do you most hope folks would take away from this book? Like, what's the takeaway?
You know, I've really conceived of this project as having a kind of set of different purposes depending upon the different audiences. And so, you know, I would hope that, you know, whoever the reader is, they'll find it fascinating and a kind of engaging work that will sort of pull them along and, you know, as a kind of unfolding. But for, you know, for a larger practitioner audience, you know, I would really hope that this would bring a kind of larger contextual understanding of the history and philosophy of yoga, and not only the kind of inner, you know, dynamics of practice. I mean, I would hope someone would come out of this book really understanding the key concepts that have informed yoga practice throughout its history, but also its kind of social, cultural context, you know, the ways in which issues like politics and economics, you know, gender and sexuality and other things come into play in the picture that would inform their perspective on their own practice and maybe open their eyes to elements of the contemporary yoga sort of scene and phenomenon that they hadn't seen before. For the more scholarly crowd, you know, I would hope that this would serve as a resource for, say, you know, upper division undergraduates or graduate students who really want to get at least one kind of larger narrative of this, coherent narrative to kind of build upon. And for scholars, I hope, you know, it provokes some discussion on a number of really, really important theoretical fronts within the contemporary study of yoga. I mean, it's given me an opportunity to kind of showcase many of what I see as my key theoretical insights. But I've done it in a way that doesn't spend a lot of time saying scholar X is arguing with scholar Y, etc. If you want that level, you really have to go to the notes, in part because I wanted something that was, you know, coherent and accessible, while at the same time is undergirded by this sort of framework of theory. I will say there are a few things that really came out of the larger arc of the work for me. One is, you know, the importance of the Hindu and especially Vedic roots of yoga really came through to me. Actually, we were just talking about the distinction between the Brahmana or priestly class and the Kshatriya or warrior class. You know, the importance of military and martial arts as an element of yogic theory and practice, and the kind of interface between yogic and that kind of military work, the importance of mantra, the importance of aushadhi, of herbs and psychoactive substances as not necessarily just a kind of accessory out there, but as a kind of critical component of the development of yogic practices and disciplines. So that's a lot already, but in what I'm really trying to get at is hopefully readers coming from a variety of different places will get, you know, things that are relevant and useful for them in whatever capacity they're entering this conversation.
Fascinating. Is there anything else about the book you had hoped we would highlight in our conversation you'd like to talk about?
No, I think we were pretty comprehensive, Raj, and I really appreciate having the opportunity to talk about it.
Well, it's my pleasure. This is a labor of love. And among many functions of this podcast is lockdown sanity for listeners and the host alike. And at times, lockdown insanity. And in many ways, perhaps, this is a needed indulgence for an extrovert who happens to be a textual scholar of Sanskrit narrative. I don't know why I didn't study people, but anyhow. No, it's been lots of fun. Before we close, why don't you tell folks what you're working on now?
Yes, I've got several projects that I'm working on right now. One of them is a project linking religion and technology, and in particular, looking at the ways in which this dynamic between, the attainment of power and spiritual, if not ethical, transformation can be applied to emergent technologies of human augmentation or human enhancement. And in that, I'm really looking at, among other things, the interface between certain contemplative technologies, the practices of yoga and meditation, and psychedelics within the contemporary context. So that's one of the key projects I'm working on. I also have some other much more yoga-specific work being done. I'm in the process of completing a paper that looks at the notions of nirguna and saguna Ishvara, the idea of either a God who has form or God who is formless, as might be intimated within the context of the Patanjali yoga system. And and a few other things that are sort of side hustles that I'm working on that may become bigger projects. One of them being a book comparing the Ashtanga yoga system with the Ashtanga or Ashtangika Marga, the eightfold framework within the Buddhist tradition. So a lot to go with there.
So you're bored, essentially. You're a busy boy.
Well, I think like the opposite. I've got so much to work on. It's always a challenge to decide, you know, where to put my, you know, where my energy is most.
Yes, exactly. You're
yeah.
You're a busy boy. You make me look lazy. That's great. great. Okay, so we'll close for today. Just stay on after I close. So for those of you listening, we have been speaking with Dr. Stuart Ray Sarbacher, who's associate professor at the School of History, Philosophy, and Religion at Oregon State University. We've been talking about a fantastic book, which officially comes out New Year's Day 2021, A New Beginning for All of Us, called Tracing the Path of Yoga, the History and Philosophy of Indian Mind-Body Discipline, SUNY Press 2021. Thank you for appearing on the podcast.
It's been my pleasure, Raj. Thanks for having me.
And for those of you listening, stay safe, stay sane, keep reading, keep listening, and keep contemplating this crazy thing called yoga.